Journal Sir David Thorne, Reel 3. You were saying that your life was based to a certain extent around your sporting activities.
That's right. And that's what gave me a really strong entree to friendships with numbers of people. And right from the outset, I got into the squash team, got into the cricket team, was a useful rugby player and a useful hockey player. And that really meant I wasn't always dashing up. I didn't really like it. And I didn't have the money anyway, like some cadets. I didn't have any personal money. I lived on what I'd got. And I think that also is a very good thing, because it means you're working with the majority of Sanders who didn't have millions anyway. And they needed to make their own lives. And we had a little bit of money, and we could go out into Camberley, or we could... I think usually it was the sport that really gave one's relaxation. And it was excellently organised.
What about the formal side of social activities at
centres? Guest nights and so on, yes, all of that happened. And we were well trained like that, and we were trained to respect the system and to enjoy it and to think that it was something of something colourful and something traditional. And, you know, some people don't like tradition, just like some people don't like drill. I've always rather liked tradition, but have become exhilarated when I've been able to get away from tradition and do something out in the open, so fresh and absolutely new. Tradition is safe. It's traditional. And that also is comfortable. And if it's colourful as well, then it's very nice to do. But I'm much more attracted now, from experience, to picking up a cause with young or old people, but a real cause. And if it's new in terms of what you've got to do, then it's even better. And that's what I enjoy above all. But it's taken me a long time to understand that traditional is fine, but it can be stultifying.
Do you think, looking back on it, that the conditions at Sandhurst were stultifying because of the importance of tradition?
Yes.
In what respect?
It's one of our national problems, I think, is that we're an old country, no street is straight. We have a real and genuine, and I think quite a good respect for tradition. But it can be too great a respect. We can be, in a sense, uncomfortable with change. And I think it's understanding that change and moving forward is inevitable, two is exciting and invigorating, and that certain aspects of tradition may outgrow their usefulness. And I never looked at it like that when I was at Sandhurst. I just accepted that the teaching was right, that the tradition was right. I didn't question it. I think a more questioning attitude at that time for young officers, which is, you know, it's quite a difficult balance. On one hand, you're telling people that discipline and obedience and corporate teamwork is fundamental, and the next you're saying, look, you need to think your way in to everything and to understand and comprehend from a logical point of view and be prepared to challenge. I think that that's one of the most interesting balances in producing the most effective possible army in when you've got small resources but large responsibilities.
Well, the essential question is, at what point do you start allowing real Auftrag's tactique rather than Befehl's tactique?
Yes, absolutely.
How far down the line does it go? And it really depends partly on the circumstances, doesn't it?
It does, and it depends upon the resources are set against the task. And you may be forced into giving initiative down to the very lowest level, and indeed that's what I favour. And I also am a great believer now, having left the army, in parallel or lateral provision of responsibility. So, for instance, I just, in the last 2.5 years, been involved in a major event with the heads of government meeting in the Commonwealth. And there, basically, were three people involved in the core management and driving forward of this. And that was myself and two 26-year-olds. And everybody knew from number 10 Downing Street down that they had the same authority as me, because I gave it to them and they used it, and this was understood.
How far can you spread that in a triumvirate if you're working together and you've got the same basic philosophy and ideas? One can see
I think you can spread it as far as you can find the right people who do not abuse it. And it is a method which is only for an intelligent society with disciplined people who understand that they hold each other up, that ultimately one of those people carries the ultimate responsibility, but that the extent to which that person can devolve his or her responsibility, and other people can pick it up with respect, to that extent you can achieve greater momentum with a small number of people. And in terms of war and leadership, there's a distinct limit to how far you can do it, because there you add fear. Mark you. You can add fear, loss of reputation, and things like that, very quickly in the way that I'm propounding, and which I'm certainly going to practice again in the next year and a half. And everybody knows it. I told them they're going to do it that way. But it's riskier, but it's also an exhilarating way of getting the best out of people.
Do you think that people, in particular soldiers, to a certain extent, enjoy being frightened?
Good soldiers never enjoy being frightened, but they learn how to use that fear as a stimulus to effective action. I think soldiers who are immature, who are quite dangerous people, then, may enjoy being frightened, but probably not for long, because they'll come and get something horrible. I think the real test is if you know you've got to do something. I, in one way, I think soldiers and people who have to carry out dangerous tasks may need to use fear as a stimulus, but I don't think they enjoy it. I think they know that it may be essential to getting the very best out of themselves. I know, from my point of view, I enjoy the achievement of something that is perceived, perhaps, or perceived by me as risky.
Would it be better to say that they enjoy confronting fear and overcoming it?
Yes.
Is that a different term?
I think the good ones learn to understand the process and how it can be done. And that's a very important thing, and to pass on to others and to take others with you in a way that's responsible and brings out the best in people and results in success. And some tasks have to be done this way, and some people have to be trained and learn to train themselves and others in how to cope with those particular situations.
Do you think that you got that sort of training while you were at Sandhurst? Did it give you those ideas?
No. I have learned all of that from the experiences I've got when I've been set at risk. And I think some of it is innate and inside you, and some of it depends on who you've got with you at that time when you first set yourself or were set against this particular task which created fear because it was risky. Because it was difficult. And so, in a sense, there's an element of luck in this, there's an element of character, there's an element of intelligent analysis and steeling yourself. There's an element of basically raw moral courage.
Is this something that can be taught in a formal way?
I think it could be talked about.
That's not the same thing as being taught.
No, exactly. I think much of it needs to be experienced with people who've been through it themselves. And then certain people will come forward, plainly, who are good at handling themselves and working with others in those sort of situations. A lot of it is about character and the way one responds to the fear of failure.
There is a theory that says that leaders are born, not made, and that Sandhurst develops born leaders rather than making leaders.
Mm.
What would you say to that proposition?
I don't think leaders are made. I do think they have to have certain qualities inside them of character and inner courage, and above all moral courage, but also physical courage, which puts them into the ballpark. Then I think your Sandhursts and your whatever it may else may be in terms of training can discover that they have, if they'd given them the right sort of tests, discover that they have the right sort of characteristics, and can give them one or two guidelines which they need to think about. But in the end, the only way you ever learn is by setting yourself against tasks at an early age, preferably, where the failure doesn't matter too much, so that when it comes to the crunch, you've been through one or two hoops already, you've learnt some basic principles that are good for you and good for others with you, and you just develop as you grow older, sometimes very fast. And I think that the first one or two times you meet up with that sort of situation, there need to be at least one success, because it's a raw situation, and you can soon be sort of burnt off in terms of confidence if you don't have that success.
Would you say then that what Sandhurst did for you was to create artificial mock hoops which provided you with an element of confidence when you approached your first real hoop?
Yes. It also taught me, reminded me, that I can quite easily develop a strong affection and belief in the people around me. That's not essential to other people's leadership, but it's very important to mine.
Can you be a cold leader?
Yes, I think you can.
Can a cold and calculating leader be as effective as an instinctive and warm leader?
It's a matter of judgment. If his cool approach and his detached approach produces for him the judgments that will lead to success, then I think people will bow with him or her. But it'll be more difficult. And there are a lot of leaders, you know, you and I would know, who have been relative failures, but have been such warm and decent and contactable people that, in a sense, their soldiers around them have gathered them up when they've taken a fall. And in a sense, they've learnt through that relationship with their soldiers and have been carried forward. But I think there needs to be a powerful element of judgment and of moral courage in any leader, and a sufficiency of intelligence. And in a sense, these are defined in your early years. And then you learn whether you can fire people. And people soon learn. And in a sense, if you can add to that an element of humility, and I think that, for me, is a very important thing. If people in this present day and age see a leader who is a genuine leader, who has these qualities, and who also puts them to the front when the praise is to be given, then they follow that guy, male or female, to the end of the world. Whereas if that guy either some of these pompous bunny buffoons who we do produce, and you know, and who get very high in the army. And perhaps I'm being too rude about this, but broadly, people who have an ego the size of a house. In this age, they get seen through much quicker than ever before.
Would you say then that the ordinary soldier has become more demanding?
Yes.
And he requires a higher quality of leadership.
Yes, and I think it's a very good thing.
I mean, could you spot the potential buffoons with house-sized egos?
Yes.
From the earliest stages, or did they develop later?
I used the wrong word, buffoon. Mm. The people who get forward are not buffoons. They're very able people. But they have a real itch to be in the centre of the stage themselves. After the party's over, after the war has been won, to take more than their credit at times, and to advance themselves. And that runs right against the very excellent motto of Sandhurst, which is serve to lead, which I think is one of the finest and most important things that Sandhurst did teach me, and which starts with that the officers only eat when all the men have eaten in the field. And that is an absolutely hard and fast rule, and I have to say that I think in some regiments it was not observed as well as it should be, but in other regiments it was absolutely, and most of them, it was absolutely essential, and that when their soldiers needed care and attention, that it was the officer's duty to do this and to do it tirelessly. So I think that sense of duty and a sense of service was well taught to me at Sandhurst and has served me well all my life, but out of the army and in it was very important.
Now, in the 1950s, the early 1950s, when you were at Sandhurst, there were stirring things going on. The war in Korea was raging away until 1953.
Right.
The new atomic and nuclear weapons were being developed.
Mm.
And the Cold War was intensifying to a certain extent. Were you aware of the general political situation in the world as a Sandhurst cadet?
I was aware of it, and Sandhurst were pretty good about sort of making us be aware. But I have to say, my perception was that of a young platoon commander wanting to get as fast as possible to the 30 men he was going to lead, who were going to be the best bloody platoon in the army, certainly in the regiment, and were going to be tremendous at marching and shooting and communicating, and were going to be a powerful team. That's what mattered to me.
Did you have any expectations of whether there was likely to be or not to be a major armed conflict in Europe when you were a cadet?
I think that was part of the cloth model business.
Yes. Do you remember if you ever thought that leading your platoon into battle against the Russian army might be
a possibility.
Real prospect?
Without a doubt, yes. A real prospect.
Was it a probability? You said a possibility.
I think I've relied too much on the good advice of the general view, which was that as long as we were well prepared, that the odds were that wouldn't happen. What was much more likely, would there be some small conflagration somewhere else in the world,
East
and hopefully the battalion would be grabbed and would be sent out there. Much more fun to be out where, even if it was only a battalion having to solve the problem rather than the bloody great army.
Now, this, of course, is in that great tradition of colonial soldiering, isn't it? The small expeditionary force going off at the end of a long line of communication to do what it could and improvise and make things up as it went along.
That's right.
And that was the sort of prospect that was most engaging.
That was the prospect which attracted, and now that we've thought about it, the prospect of digging great big nuclear trenches in Germany and whatever, and the Russian hordes, under the tactics and strategies that went with it. Yes, we did our dutiful best to absorb that. But what we wanted, and I wanted, was to get to the first battalion of the 9th of foot as fast as possible, having performed really well on the sports field and got as high of a ladder as I could at Sandhurst, and then to start to lead as many men as possible in that platoon and enjoy that company and make things good.
Did I mean, you mentioned the nuclear trenches and so forth. Mm. Was the tactical training you did exclusively and purely infantry, or did you bring into consideration artillery support, armour, air support, and so on?
Certainly, and I think that's one of the features of Sandhurst, is in a sense we were operating at sort of divisional and above level and a lot of our tactical thinking, but on the ground there was a lot of attention to the section and the platoon.
In your platoon within Eep Company, did you have a fair mix of people going to different arms, or were you predominantly?
Yes, we did, and we also had a number of people from foreign armies. Like we had a Dichogana, and we had a lovely Malaysian cadet whose name escapes me. But it was always very important if you were in a difficult situation to be with him, because you could guarantee that you might be bad at whatever you were doing, but he would be worse. And he was a lovely guy. And he was a great sort of source of relief to us in many ways, because we kept him upright, basically. And he was a smashing guy. But he found it very difficult to keep pace with events. And so, in a sense, he was sort of buffer between us and the worst of misfortunes, because he was always the one deepest in it.
Did he get his restriction of privileges often?
I think he was fathered through the course very well by Sergeant Major Gorman and Sergeant Babich. They knew who to give the rough end of the stick to, and on the whole, it was the more robust of the Brits were tested out to see if they'd got the caliber to be leaders in the biggest way in the academy. And the weakest links among the Brits were tested out to make sure they should be officers. Mm-hmm. And that was the most important duty.
Filtering out the no-hopers.
Yes, and identifying who were the weak links, so if they did get through, there was no mistake that they went off with a little mark under their name saying, look, you need to be watched quite carefully.
Mm. What happened to you then at the end of the Sandhurst training?
End of Sandhurst training, well, I mean, it was a very happy time because basically I'd done well there. I'd been a JRO and I finished, I think, 12th in the Order of Merit.
How was that actually assessed? Were there formal exams to
exams,
establish Order of Merit?
It was merit, it was performance, it was all your exams and all that sort of jazz, all added up. And so, you know, we had a great party or two and then we were given a bit of leave, not too much, and then told report to the regimental depot at the 9th of foot. Well, off we went. I and Second Lieutenant Peter Davies, and we found up there where Hubert Holden, who was one of the great sort of characters of the regiment, was charged with the depot. He at that time had a family castle in Shropshire. He was this sort of that sort of guy. He was of staunch 9th of foot, you know, Rule Britannia guy, very civilised, much in the mould of Dicey Grattan, the company commander who I first had at
the pre-war regular.
Yeah, pre-war regular, but a man of real style, lovely, lovely temperament. Could, in a sense, we could mould ourselves on him, and it was a sort of, you know, the sort of personality that made everybody comfortable. And from private soldier through to the sergeant major, they all liked him. And there we rapidly taught one or two lessons. One of them by the sergeant major there, his name was Winky Fitt, who features in that book enormously, and who's just died. And let me just, it's worth giving a little vignette or two on Winky Fitt. Because when Peter Davies and I arrived in the depot, we had a couple of months, because I think the battalion was just returning to coast in Hong Kong.
That's right.
The battalion was just returning from Hong Kong, so we were kept at the depot, and we were given a bit of training to do. Winky On one occasion, we had to go out to the range to do some fuel firing. There's some actually some range work. At the end of the range work, Winky said to Peter and I, "Right, so you can leave the range now. I'll finish all this off." And so off we went. When we got back to the barracks, Winky turned up, and he went to see the Hubert Holden at Capitolina, and he said there were some empty cases left on the range, and Lieutenant Thorne and Lieutenant Davis were in charge. So, rather like Dusty Berry, when we march, you know, cases on the range, you, in the future, you never again, extra duty officers, blah, blah, blah. Now, Winky, this guy who did tremendous things with the 2nd Battalion at Kohima, and is in this book about the 2nd Battalion, he's a heroic figure. We didn't mind. We knew he wanted to make a point to us. And if I say to you that Winky's just died, and up to the time when he died, he'd be ringing me in London at the Royal Cornwall Society, which I was running until about 9 months ago, and be reporting to me still, when he was dying of cancer, about what he'd been doing, about the old soldiers this week, and who we'd spoken to, and which part of the civil service in Norwich he'd got a grip of. Anyway, he stayed a regimental sergeant major, as he eventually became, until he died. And, you know, he's part of our family, and I was part of his family. And okay, he sorted us out when we came in as the second lieutenants, but we stayed friends, and he taught us. So, you know, we were back into the fold of the regiment where I'd started from.
Were you given a platoon as soon as you got to the depot? Was that the first thing you
happened? Basically, helped. We were put into sort of understudy the platoon commanders who were already there, and to help things happen. So we were out on Thetford Battle Arrow, we were doing those things until the battalion settled back into Romanway Camp down the road in Colchester, and then we both went down there.
So effectively, you were attached to platoons. Would this be for familiarisation?
That's right.
Read yourselves into the.
To be sort of supernumerary officers, getting the feel of the depot, understanding what was going on until we could be moved into joining the battalion on their settling into Colchester.
While you were at the depot, did you get an impression of to what extent you were getting regulars as opposed to national service soldiers in as recruits?
We just felt we were getting national servicemen, and there were a few regulars who were there, but that it was not an army that made it easy for, because it was conscript, for a lot of regulars to be, you know, in a sense, you need a certain level of regular element within the battalion or the depot to make it worthwhile for others to join. They need their own good company, otherwise they're constantly seeing people disappear.
But there's some element also of national servicemen who might never have taken to military life had they not been called up, who
absolutely
do enlist.
One of the joys of national service was that a high number of intelligent and able people came into the army for 2 years, certainly into the 9th of Foot. And again, I've stayed friends with numbers of them all my life. In fact, one of them just rang me up today, saying, "Come on, I want to come to lunch and talk about what you're doing in this latest job you're doing." You know, and that's, he was a second lieutenant.
National service second lieutenant.
We've got a very strong regimental association, and a lot of them now are from the period 1950 to 1960. We're moving on from World War to now. The old boys are getting too old, although a lot of my time as president of the regimental association is spent looking after those ones that are, through the regimental secretary and others, looking after those ones who are now the last of the World War II people.
Were most of your recruits from Norfolk?
Yes. Majority. Some from Essex, some from Suffolk, Cambridgeshire. And that's been traditional. And some from Ireland. always had some from Ireland, Northern Ireland. There's a platoon